Western science is based on observation. When Galileo dropped two objects from a tower to compare their rate of fall, his purpose was to observe what happened and to derive a principle of physics from that observation. When he observed that objects fall at the same rate of speed, his purpose was fulfilled. He was not attempting to deal with anything that he could not see and measure. For example, Galileo wasn't trying to answer the question of why objects fall at the same rate, or whether this was ethical or beautiful or funny or sad. This is a fundamental principle of science, and it has brought many positive changes into the world. But although science focuses on what can be objectively measured, this does not mean that what can't be measured isn't important. In fact, what can't be measured might be more important for that very reason. The power of intention is a good example of a force that's difficult to measure, but that is undeniably important. The law, for example, recognizes the role of intention in human behavior. If someone is injured as a result of another person's actions, the law considers whether the actions were intentional or accidental. The presence or absence of intention can mean the difference between a criminal act or simply a negligent one. And even science has discovered that we can't rely just on measurable observations to the exclusion of intentions and expectations. If we perform an experiment that's designed to prove that light is a particle, the results will bear out that intention. But if we intend that light is a wave, we'll find that it does in fact turn out to be a wave. The measurable results are literally created by the intentions of the observer. In our personal lives, we also recognize the importance of intention, though there seems to be a certain mystery about it that has negative connotations for some people. I've heard people say that they don't want to wish for something to happen because they know if they wish for it, their wish won't come true. As if this very idea of intending a desired outcome causes a backlash against you at the cosmic level. And there's also a saying that goes something like this: be careful what you wish for, because you might get it. In other words, you'll be punished for your presumption. This same idea is found in a number of fairy tales. The queen wishes for a child, and an old witch appears and says, "I'll bring you a child, but there will be some terrible price to pay." I don't agree with any of this. I don't think there's anything wrong about wishing for what you want, except that the very word wishing seems to imply a kind of doubt about the outcome. People talk about wishing they'll win the lottery. Instead of wishing, I believe in intending, although I don't believe you can really intend to win the lottery and have it happen, because those kind of ego-bound aspirations aren't part of the spiritual intention that is the subject of this session. But if you intend abundance in the truest sense of the word, you can definitely materialize it. You can definitely foster synchronicities that will create material and spiritual wealth. And in fact, I've written a book on that topic entitled Creating Affluence. When a person has achieved a certain level of consciousness, whatever he or she intends simply happens. I have known people like this. There was a man who caused me to be 4 hours late for an airplane flight. I said, "I'm sorry, I'm really going to have to leave now because I'm going to miss my plane." And he said, "Don't worry, the plane will be late." And he kept me for 4 hours. Finally, I arrived at the airport and I was sure I had missed my plane. But they said, "Oh, there's been a 4-hour delay." So there are people who are so connected with the conscious energy field that every intent manifests itself. If you're a person like that, your intent is so alive and so powerful that the whole order of the universe orchestrates around it. I should have said, of course, that this man was a former teacher of mine and that he was, in fact, enlightened. Of course, there's another way of looking at it too. Your mind may be so closely aligned with the cosmic mind that you think you're getting your desires met, but really the cosmic mind is simply using your mind to get its own desires met. The ego-based identity that comes into being when there's a separation from the conscious energy field has simply dissolved, and the distinction between what you intend and what the universe intends becomes meaningless. you think your desires are being fulfilled, but actually it's the cosmic mind that's using you as the instrument to fulfill its desire. So in this session and the one that follows, we're going to be talking about the infinite organizing power of intent. Remember, synchrodestiny is synchronicity plus intent. Synchrodestiny is coincidence plus direction. Meaningful coincidence is meaningful because it's moving in the direction of the spiritual evolution. And spiritual evolution is truly the grand design of the universe. It's so important to remember that synchronicity increases if you pay attention to it. The more attention you pay to it, and the more intention you bring to it, the more it increases. So if you have a synchronistic experience, I suggest you pay as much attention to it as you can. Write it down in a notebook. Discuss it with other people. And if you want to enlist synchronicity in order to manifest a certain worthy desire, start intending that. Start being aware of events that seem to point in that direction. Start being aware of what I call the conspiracy of improbabilities. We'll devote a whole session to this later in the program. Whenever something remarkable happens in your life, and remarkable things happen all the time, don't be content to just say, "Oh, what a coincidence. That's very interesting." It's important to go one step beyond that. What's the real significance? What's the karmic significance? What's the next step? How do I make use of the synchronicity? Because synchronicity is just coincidence if it's not used. It's just an interesting phenomenon. But when it's used and understood and linked to the power of intent, then it's synchrodestiny. In the same way, true intention requires focus. For example, there's a difference between intent and impulse. If I'm walking through an airport and I suddenly decide to buy a magazine, I would not call that an intention in the sense that we're talking about. Even if I suddenly decided to fly to Chicago instead of San Francisco, that would not necessarily be an intention, because intent requires mindfulness. Intent requires awareness. An intention is not simply a whim, but also there's something paradoxical about this. Although intention requires attention, it also requires detachment. You must be able to detach from the outcome, despite the fact that you've created the intention mindfully and with full awareness. Once the intention has been sent out into the universe, you must detach from it just as if it were the simplest purchase of a newspaper or a package of chewing gum. If you focus on the outcome of an intention, you won't allow the synchronistic nature of the universe to handle the details. Your ego will become involved. You'll feel frustrated if your intention isn't realized soon enough. Your sense of self-importance will be threatened, and you'll start feeling sorry for yourself. All of these terrible things happen when you focus on the outcome rather than the purity of the intent itself. So let's talk about intent right now. I try to understand synchronicity from a scientific perspective because that's my background, that's my training. I try to relate the topic of meaningful coincidence to an understanding of what scientists have said about how nature works. One of the first people to talk about intent in connection with biology and evolution was a French scientist named Lamarck. He was a contemporary of Charles Darwin. Lamarck was a revolutionary thinker, and his ideas are now being looked at very closely in scientific circles. Lamarck was out of favor and discredited for many years, but now his theories are getting close attention. He was one of the first people to champion the idea of species evolution, although he explained the process in a way that sharply conflicted with Darwin. Lamarck used a term called teleology. And what teleology simply means is that if you want to know the mechanics of something in evolution in biology, then you must first understand the intended outcome. Lamarck said that if you know the intended outcome, then you can predict the mechanics of a biological process. So according to him, a giraffe has a long neck because the intended outcome was survival, and that implied the ability to reach up into a tree to get something to eat. It's as if giraffes as a species have this adaptation as a kind of collective intention. We've got to reach up into the branches in order to survive, and if we could do that, we'd have long necks. So the intention to have long necks asserts itself and manifests itself over generations, and giraffes as a species do in fact survive. In the same way, a camel has a hump because the intended outcome is walking through the desert for several days without having access to water. Lamarck explained everything in biology and evolution in terms of intent. So he was different from Darwin, who says evolution is basically accidental. According to Darwin, evolution is a process of natural selection of species who are able to respond successfully to environmental challenges. But Lamarck said, if you know the intent, then you can predict the mechanisms that will evolve. That it's not just a matter of a species accidentally adapting or evolving in a way that allows it to survive. Over the last several years, scientists have started accepting Lamarck because some of the best explanations in biology are teleological explanations. Scientific experiments can be designed teleologically. In other words, we can look at the ultimate intent and then we can work backward to what the mechanisms could be. At scientific conferences, you can hear natural process explained based on the fact that they make teleological sense. So according to Lamarck, intent creates the biological response that is necessary to fulfill the intent. For example, how does a parrot learn to simulate human language? How does a little parrot with a brain smaller than a fingernail, with hardly any vocal cords, and a beak rather than the mouth, how does this thing learn to speak English or French or Swahili? A friend of mine has a parrot that sings Beach Boy songs. It's totally amazing that that could happen. If I were a scientist and I had to study every step in a parrot learning to sing a Beach Boy song, it would take me forever. Yet Lamarck would say, there is an intent that's present there, and the intent orchestrates its own fulfillment. That the intent, in fact, has infinite organizing power. And that this is how nature works. It all derives from intent, and all intent originally had only one function. That was survival. So the intent was survival, and nature created the mechanism to fulfill that intent. For example, a honeybee looks at the environment through perception of ultraviolet light. A honeybee's eye cells respond to ultraviolet because the bee has to survive by drinking the nectar of a flower, and the only way it can see the nectar in the flower is through receptors that respond to ultraviolet. So in order to survive, the honeybee literally develops the receptors for ultraviolet. Here's another example. A bat navigates at night. It can't see, it doesn't have eyes. So in order to survive, it develops the apparatus to send out ultrasonic sound waves and respond to them. Once again, the intent to survive develops the mechanism for survival. That was originally the reason. So from a cosmic perspective, we can look at the conscious energy field and infer that the field is manifesting its own intention in the reality that surrounds us. Matter of all kinds, including your body and my body, are manifestations of cosmic intent. That's simply what we are, and that's also the basis of what happens in our lives. There's an intent on the part of the universe, and that intent then organizes its own fulfillment. Once we really understand that, we can also understand the arrogance that underlies many of our assumptions. The human body and the nervous system are expressions of the cosmic energy field. But if we intend something, it's our arrogance to assume that we are originating that intent. It's actually cosmic intent that is acting through us. In fact, our ego-based arrogance assumes that we originate the intent, but our arrogance interferes with the true intent that originates at the cosmic level. That's a dilemma that only humans have, because if you look at other species, there's no such problem. They just act out the cosmic intent. So a homing pigeon will find its way home instinctively. Its ego needs don't get in the way. There's a very interesting book entitled Seven Experiments That Could Change the World by English biologist Rupert Sheldrake. He's a controversial figure in scientific circles. Some people say he's the next Darwin, and other people think he's completely wrong in everything he says. Sheldrake has looked very closely at the issue of intent in nature. He studied the ability of pigeons to navigate their way home over great distances, and he's also done some wonderful experiments on the power of intention to influence human behavior. For example, Sheldrake set up a television camera to focus on some people in a distant setting. He also had some people watching the scenario several miles away on a screen. And as the people focus their attention on the screen, you can see that the person who's being watched becomes a bit uneasy, because somehow he knows he's being watched. He starts getting fidgety. He starts scratching his neck, and he seems to be looking around for the camera. You can try versions of this yourself. The next time you're sitting in an airplane or in a theater, choose somebody in the audience and look at the back of their neck. Focus your attention and intend that they turn back and look at you. You'll be surprised at how often it works. But the real important point is that intent in nature orchestrates its own fulfillment. So what could interfere with that? The only thing that could interfere is us, our own ego needs and intentions. Because we are so smart, we have this very powerful intellect, and it separates us and brings us into conflict with the cosmic intent. And even our doubt that all this is true is part of that separation. We've seen how intention is a powerful force in nature. We've also talked a bit about how we can become separated or alienated from that larger intention as a result of our own ego-driven desires and needs. Now let's focus on what we can do to realign ourselves with cosmic intent. What you can do to create harmony between what you intend and what the universe intends for you. Once that harmony is created, once that congruence is brought into being, you'll find that synchronicity becomes a greater presence in your life. And this, of course, is one of the strongest indicators of spiritual transformation. As a precondition for any intention on your part, I would suggest nurturing a viewpoint of simple gratitude. Just start with a feeling of being grateful. So even before you have the intent, you say, "I acknowledge my gratitude. I give thanks for my place in the cosmos and for the opportunity I have to further the destiny we all share." So the first requirement of positive intent is acknowledging gratitude. And the second thing is to abandon grievance of all kinds. Grievance comes from the ego. There's a beautiful passage in The Course of Miracles, which is a very interesting set of books that you may already be familiar with. The passage says, "Every decision I make is a choice between a grievance and a miracle." Try to remember that. Every decision you make is a choice between a grievance and a miracle. So the first thing is acknowledge gratitude before you start any intent. And the second thing is abandon all grievances. Again, this is an area of concern that's unique to us as human beings. Animals don't have any problems with grudges or grievances. If you hurt an animal, it will learn from that experience and it will avoid you in order to being hurt again in the future. But the animal doesn't really have a grievance inside it. It doesn't say to itself, "This person is violent, so I'm going to get revenge." That really doesn't happen in the natural world. An animal that's been hurt may try to kill you the next time you're around, but this is a survival response in the interest of the whole species. In India, it's very well known that if you kill a cobra, all the other snakes in the family become very vicious. If you're anywhere in the vicinity of those snakes, you have to be very careful, because the survival response of the species is triggered when their number is diminished. But there's no emotional need on the part of the animals to get back at you. There's no plotting it or thinking about it all day. It's a survival thing. Nature's intent is the survival of the species. and the individuals are simply channeling that intention. You don't have to be a scientist to understand these issues. People who spend lots of time in natural environments are very acutely aware of intention as a factor in behavior. Hunters know this extremely well. A hunter can walk through the forest with a loaded gun, but unless he has the intention of firing the gun, there's no evasive response on the part of the animals in the area. But as soon as there's an active intent to hunt and fire the gun, then the animal's behavior changes. They sense the intention, and they understand it. When I was growing up in India, we had a neighbor who had a chicken farm. Every Sunday, they would have a barbecue, and the neighbor would come out and start looking over the chickens. Maybe he'd think, "Oh, how about that nice, plump, black one there?" And as soon as that thought entered his mind, the black hen would run, and all the other hens would get out of the way. Even they would know what the intention was. In any case, it's only among human beings that intention is encumbered by all sorts of emotional baggage, and that's what you want to get rid of in order to create a pure intention. Abandon all emotional baggage, but the most important aspect of this is getting rid of grievances, getting rid of ego-driven static. Your intention should be in timeless awareness. There should be no ego in the way. Pure intention should be completely natural and effortless. No straining, because if you strain, it's not going to happen. In nature, there's no strain. It's effortless spontaneity. When the pigeon is flying back to its loft in England, it isn't saying, "How do I get there? When am I going to get there? What if I don't get there? Or what if another pigeon gets there before me?" It just flies. It goes where it wants to go. There's no strain. It's effortless and spontaneous. It's also a kind of surrender to the larger intention that transcends the individual identity. We have to learn to say, "It's not just happening in here inside me, it's also happening out there in the larger environment, which is expressing itself through me." That's an inner attitude of surrender. Spirit-based intention is so powerful. Once you know that, you'll realize that nothing is beyond you. Nurturing synchronicity is really a simple thing for the power of intention to accomplish. If you've ever seen that power in action, you'll understand that. The medical school I attended in India had a very American orientation. But there were some Indian professors there who were very interested in studying yoga and the powers that a yogi is able to acquire. I remember one day we had a young yogi come in to give a demonstration. He stood there and took a knife and he put it right through the biceps muscle of his arm. And there was no bleeding, no blood whatsoever. How does something like that happen? Well, it happens because there's a very strong and pure intent. Techniques like this, including acupuncture, anesthesia, and other Eastern healing methods, are derived from the idea that you can convince the conscious energy field to behave in a certain way by the power of your intention. So when the yogi put the knife through his arm, the intent he directed at the field was, "Don't bleed." Of course, the yogi also experiences his body as a conscious energy field, not necessarily as flesh and blood. When they saw this man plunge the knife through his arm, everybody was in shock. But there was one doctor sitting in the front row who didn't believe it. He thought it was a trick because it didn't fit his conceptual paradigm of what was possible. What he was seeing didn't fit his ideas of how the human body reacts when it's stuck by a knife. So this doctor in the front row actually started teasing and taunting the young yogi who had plunged the knife through his arm. He started saying, "This is a fraud. This is a magic trick. Don't think you can get away with this." So then another very surprising thing happened. The yogi got offended. His ego was offended. And as soon as that happened, blood spurted out of his arm like from a fountain. It was very dramatic. His attention had gone into his ego, and his body was suddenly beyond his control. But he very quickly realized what had happened. He let go of the ego and he refused to get offended. He went back into his inner attitude of gratitude and defenselessness and regained the purity of his intent. And as soon as he did that, the bleeding stopped just as quickly as it had started. That's the power of intention. But the power instantly disappears if the ego is involved or if there is any straining or forcing. It's not going to work if the ego gets in the way. Carlos Castaneda calls the ego the 1,000-headed monster. It's the dragon each of us has to hunt and slay. Castaneda says that a good hunter deliberately seeks out petty tyrants to hurt his ego so that he can become invulnerable to taking offense or feeling insulted. Castaneda says, if you don't have a petty tyrant in your life, you really need to go out and find one. This is one of Castaneda's most powerful insights. You need a petty tyrant in your life to teach you the lessons of your ego. If you don't have one, please go and find one and then be grateful. Castaneda also said, if your ego is your internal reference point, you had better plan on feeling offended for the rest of your life. Think about that. If your ego is your internal reference point, if ego is the basis for your intentions, your entire life will be a series of offenses and perceived insults. If you're not interested in living that way, you've got to cultivate gratitude and let go of grievances. Anytime you feel offended, ask yourself, who is offended? Anytime you feel flattered, ask yourself, who is being flattered? The answer will be your own ego, because spirit can't be offended and spirit can't be flattered either. Spirit exists outside those influences. When you create an intention, there's another very important question to ask. Why do I want to use this intent? What's the real purpose of this intent? Is it just so I can take the credit for something, or is there a higher purpose as well? Is it just for yourself, or will it be helping someone else too? The primary motivator for our actions may always be to gratify our own needs, and the ego will always be present on some level in this incarnation. It's important to accept that, but it's also important not to give the ego more attention than it deserves. At certain stages of our lives, our egos are quite naturally the primary focus. Talking to a 4-year-old or an adolescent about the pitfalls of ego-based intentions probably won't be as useful as it would be at another point in life. There are certain things people have to find out for themselves before they're ready to move on to another stage of development. As we continue to grow, ego needs may continue to be there, but we can allow their importance to diminish. We can say to ourselves, I'm not going to focus so much on that. A colleague of mine was describing how he'd experienced the persistence of ego needs in his own life. He had been taking an intensive meditation course that involved as much as 12 hours of silence every day. He felt that his consciousness was really beginning to transform and evolve as a result of this. There were times when he experienced a deep state of unity with the world around him, a real sense of connection and non-judgment and cosmic awareness. Once he was sitting among a group of people, and it was as if he suddenly realized that he wasn't judging anyone or thinking about himself anymore. He realized that in a very profound way, he and the people he was with were all equals. And then this voice seemed to come up inside him and it said, you're probably the only one here who realizes that. That voice was his ego, of course, which had disappeared for a moment, but which will never entirely disappear for most of us. So the key is not to take it too seriously, to not make it the determining factor in our intentions. We don't have to get rid of the ego, we just have to be aware of where it can lead us. Ego without awareness leads to self-importance. And remember that self-importance and self-pity are the same thing. Whenever you feel self-important, it won't be long before you're feeling sorry for yourself again. synchrodestiny depends so much on our ability to cultivate intentions that are above ego needs. We've got to find opportunities to exercise those intentions, because for the most part our society doesn't provide them. It's interesting to realize that the great cathedrals of Europe were built over several generations. The people who began work on the cathedrals in Chartres and Amiens never saw the finished buildings, and they were aware that they would never see them. Their children who continued the work never saw the finished buildings either. The motivation was something beyond the prospect of taking pride in what would be accomplished, because you were never going to see what was accomplished. You were just creating the intention, and you would pass that intention on to the next generation. And then it would go on to yet another generation, until finally the building was completed. But no one could see the finished cathedral as an expression of their own ego, because it had been the work of so many people over such a long period of time. Instead, the cathedral was an experience of shared intention that transcended the limits of time and of generations. Our society doesn't provide many opportunities of this kind. We've got to create our own opportunities for spirit-based intention, and in fact, we should bring the power of intention into whatever we do. As I mentioned in an earlier session, the real challenge is to address the issues of spiritual transformation in the everyday moments of our lives. If you're like most people, there won't be many opportunities for going on a retreat to a mountaintop where you can concentrate on the development of your soul. You're much more likely to have a free moment when you're stuck in a traffic jam or while you're waiting for an important telephone call in your office. Those are the real opportunities for practicing timeless awareness and spirit-based intention. You may never get the chance to build a Gothic cathedral, but I believe that simply by intending a greater role for synchronicity in your life, you can experience something of the feeling that the builders of those great cathedrals must have felt. Don't always feel that you have to link synchronicity to the manifestation of some practical result or the achievement of some tangible goal. Meaningful coincidence and synchrodestiny can certainly have practical benefits. But if you just intend that synchronicity will become part of your life for its own sake, you'll be surprised by the transformation that will take place in your consciousness. In the next session, we'll look at other opportunities for exercising the power of pure intention, and we'll see how this power can alter both your material environment and the working of your own body.